Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What was day-to-day life for the founding father of Western philosophy, and how did the people he knew and the places he went influence his outlook on the human condition? The work of Socrates has been dissected, discussed, and debated for 2,400 years, which is particularly remarkable given that he is best known to us through the words of his students, critics, and admirers. Socrates himself did not leave behind a single written document. Historian, author, and broadcaster Bettany Hughes' new book explores what we can know about the personal life of Socrates and about the volatile time and place in which he lived. Hughes' new book is called The Hemlock Cup: Socrates, Athens, and the Search for the Good Life. Bettany, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. Very nice to be with you.
How is it that we know so much about Socrates the thinker and so little about Socrates the man?
Well, Socrates had this extraordinary biographer in the form of the philosopher Plato. Plato was his pupil and was a huge admirer of Socrates. He really loved his philosophy. He clearly loved the man as well. And all of Plato's dialogues are based on the words and the ideas of Socrates. So we get Socrates, but it's only ever via Plato.
And your goal in this project was not so much to explore his philosophy, which certainly has been done, but his personal life. Start by telling us what life was like in Athens around the time Socrates was born there in the 5th century BC.
Well, it just seemed to me that it was very important to try to get to feel a bit closer to Socrates, the real person, because exactly as you said in your introduction, really, we live the way we do because Socrates thought the way he thought, because he said the unexamined life is not worth living for a man. That really gave us the modern world and the idea that this was a place where we could ask questions about the life around us, that we could always try to be a bit better, that we could try to improve the human lot. And this was absolutely core to Socrates' philosophy. So it always seemed to me a terrible shame that he was this rather kind of remote figure to a lot of people. I think if you say the name Socrates, people imagine this kind of grey beard wafting around in a toga, you know, thinking great thoughts. And actually, Socrates was a real, living, breathing, passionate person, and a person who lived a very full life in Athens in the 5th century BC, so 2,400 years ago. And why it's time to write the book, I think, is because there's a huge amount of new archaeological evidence that can tell us exactly what life was like for the philosopher and for those men and women around him. So we can really start to jigsaw puzzle together Socrates' world. And the thing that strikes you incredibly forcibly when you start to really forensically look at the world that Socrates grew up in is actually, whereas we imagine in our heads that Athens was this very beautiful place where the Greek miracle took place, that it was this kind of golden age, all of that was true, but it was also very, very, very tough. It's kind of a bit like our times, Athens. There was a lot of unrest. There were wars going on. The city had been invaded by the Persians, and it was trying to struggle to get itself back on its feet. So I just wonder whether one of the reasons that Socrates looked for the good in the world was actually because everything around him was very bad. So he grew up in tough times, and that's what made him think that there must be a better way, there must be a way that humans can cope with life when all this awful brutality is going on around them.
Even the idea that this city-state was sort of a dirty place is interesting because, you know, in our minds, even if we know it's not true intellectually, you imagine Socrates sort of floating about in a snow-white toga and just thinking peaceful and important thoughts, but it was kind of a rough-and-tumble existence.
Oh, totally. I mean, that's so true. I think the very fact that you're saying exactly, people always imagine that he lived in this kind of white environment because, of course, we know the ancient ruins and the reproductions of the ancient ruins that we create in our modern cities as being these rather kind of pure, gleaming white columns. Mm-hmm. But just for a start, all that marble work would have been painted brilliantly gauzy, fairground, bright colours, kind of reds and greens and blues and golds. So it would have been, you know, a much kind of brighter, zingier place. And exactly as you say, it would have been very dirty as well. Two of my kind of favourite bits of archaeology that have come out of the ground in recent years, one is on display in the new Acropolis Museum in the centre of Athens, dug up from the streets where Socrates would have walked, is this blackened frying pan, terracotta frying pan, because, of course, Athens is very close to the sea, so the Athenian streets would have stunk of fried fish, and fried eggs were a great favourite with the Athenian citizens as well. So you've got to imagine the kind of smell of fried food in the air. Also, if you think about it, we know of Athens as being this place that produced beautiful, exquisite sculptures, bronze sculptures and marble sculptures. But all those amazing artworks have to be created. And actually, it's a very messy business, casting bronze. You have to have foundries. And there was a foundry right on the Acropolis itself, right in the centre of Athens. So again, when you think of Athens in Socrates' day, don't imagine this kind of perfect blue sky and perfect white columns. Imagine brightly coloured columns and smokes and smuts and industrial pollution everywhere just from the fact that they were knocking out so many of these gorgeous heroic statues.
So his father was a mason, his mother was a midwife, and her occupation in particular seemed to have a lasting impression on his view, not only of the world, but of his work within that world.
Well, I think that's right. I think the fact that she was a midwife, so her job was to bring new life into the world. And I almost think that Socrates thought that was his job too. His job was almost to be a midwife to new ideas, you know, that he had to walk through the streets of Athens and allow people in a way to give birth to kind of beautiful, new, brave ideas about the world that he lived in. I think also the fact that his father was a stonemason who got his hands dirty, his mother was a midwife, meant that actually he was a very centered and a very realistic man. You know, he wasn't brought up in the halls of kings. He wasn't brought up as a pampered aristocrat who'd never had to do a day's work. You know, he lived very much in the real world. He saw what real, ordinary, honest, hardworking people had to deal with. And for him, what was important was to try to work out how all of us can live better lives and actually can be happier, can enjoy ourselves. And again, I think that probably came from the fact, as I said, that he wasn't born with a silver spoon in his mouth. You know, he was born as an ordinary working citizen of Athens.
We mentioned in the introduction that he did not leave behind any written works, at least none that anyone has become aware of. But he was literate. What kind of education did he have?
He'd probably have had the same education as most citizens of Athens. It would have been a slave who would have taught him to read and write. Again, we should never forget that Athens was the most sensational place and a beautiful and a high-minded place in many ways. But actually, a lot of that philosophy and art and rhetoric was only possible because citizens were outnumbered 3-1 by slaves. So there was a huge slave population basically doing the dirty work for all the Athenian citizens, which gave them a lot of hours in the day to kind of think these great thoughts. It's now estimated, we've had a look at the bone evidence of young men from the period, and we think that probably well-born young men would have spent up to 8 hours each day in the gymnasium, just because they had all that time on their hands. So they would have been incredibly fit, but it's kind of hard for us to get our heads around now. So I think Socrates would have probably been educated by a slave, possibly by his mother as well, because women were thought to be very important in teaching their children to read and write in Athens. And this actually was one of the most radical and extraordinary and forward-thinking things that the city did during Socrates' lifetime. Is, of course, this is where democracy is born. And if you have a democracy, people have to be literate. They have to be able to read the new laws that their democratic peers have published. And so probably about 80% of the people in Athens were literate in Socrates' day, which is extraordinary, you know, because throughout the whole of the ancient world, probably the highest number of literate people you'd get in any city would be kind of 2%, maybe 3%. So it's a huge level of literacy. So Socrates, I think, would have been taught, as his other Athenian citizens were taught, by a slave. But as you say, very, very interesting. He had a real suspicion of the written words. He didn't like to use it, which is why we don't have any of his words written down, because he thought there was always the danger of misunderstandings when people pass letters from one person to another. He thought, actually, you can only have a really honest, good, robust debate if you're doing it face-to-face. And he writes about that. He says that, you know, writing, there's a real problem, that if once writing is out there, its father can't protect it any longer, so it can be misinterpreted and misunderstood. And I have to say, every time I read those words of Socrates, I do think, gosh, he really saw our world coming in many ways. If you think of the WikiLeaks scandal, how actually, because those words were written down, and once they get into the wrong hands, their fathers can no longer protect them. So it's one of the things which is really brilliant about Socrates, I think, that he almost imagines, he imagines the future before it's happened. His mind is that big that he can see the problems of the world before they're actually made flesh.
Are we sure that we have the real words of Socrates through his students and the playwrights who chose to document his life?
Well, of course, that's the million-dollar question for the historian. In a way, how can you possibly write a history of the man when we only have verbatim accounts, which are hearsay? So it's as you say, it's his students, Plato, it's his friend and, again, loyal follower, Xenophon, the historian Xenophon, who wrote about him. Aristophanes, the comic playwright, also tells us about Socrates. But what you can do, and this is what I've tried to do in the book, is you look at the moments where those three authors agree with one another about Socrates, when they say something about him which, unless they'd all got into a room together somewhere down a back street of Athens and said, OK, this is what we're going to tell the world Socrates was like, which I have to say is incredibly unlikely because they weren't the best of friends and they're all slightly different ages. That means those must be true because it would just be too extraordinary a coincidence if those moments where all the sources agree on one another, if those sources weren't giving us a real and a true picture of Socrates. Also, what's very exciting at the moment, because there is so much new archaeology in Athens, and as I said, we're getting this much better, keener, more nuanced and truthful picture of the physical world that Socrates lived in. And actually, that world that's emerging from the earth every year, there's an excavating season, is matched up perfectly in the words of Plato. So we now know that Plato, for instance, wasn't making it up. You know, so when he describes the banks of the river that Socrates walked past with his bare feet and the kinds of trees that grew overhead and the kind of wine they drink out of the certain kinds of cups, all those things are now appearing from the earth. So as I said, we now realize that there's a lot more validity to Plato than has sometimes been suspected.
Can you describe what the gym would have been like in Socrates' day?
Yeah, so the gym, you know, very important social place. Socrates loved to go to the gym. Again, I think it's something we sort of imagine him sitting around having these great thoughts and staring up into the heavens, but he loved a sweaty workout. You know, he said he was a fiend for exercise, and he meant not just exercising his mind, but also exercising his body. These were places where the young men of the city would go, and they were incredibly important. But it wasn't just a thing of leisure going to the gym, because this is where you would get yourself fighting fit. You know, literally ready to go to fight to protect your city. And so the young men would train in the gymnasia, and really they were training there for war. And Socrates was himself a soldier, and so that's one of the reasons he spent so long in the gym, because he was preparing himself physically for the trials ahead.
My guest is historian, author, and broadcaster Bettany Hughes. Her new book is called The Hemlock Cup, Socrates, Athens, and the Search for the Good Life. Join the conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or drop an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Bettany Hughes. She's a historian, broadcaster, and author of the new book, The Hemlock Cup, Socrates, Athens, and the Search for the Good Life. You can be part of the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So, Bettany, Athens and Sparta had fought together against the Persians a century earlier, but by the time Socrates was a young man, I guess in his 30s and early 40s, they were bitter rivals.
They were indeed. So these were the two kind of superpowers of the day, in a way, who put themselves up against Persia. And exactly as you say, they had been allies, but they just had different ideologies. Athens had embraced this extraordinary radical new idea called democracy, demos, kratos, literally the kratos, the power or the grip of the demos, of the people, and was living by a democracy and by democratic ideas. Whereas Sparta, although it was an incredible place, it actually almost had been a kind of earlier form of democracy in a way before Athens, kind of 200 years before Athens discovered democracy. Sparta had decided that men should all live equally in the Spartan city-state, that they should own land equally, and that all Spartan men should be nothing other than professional soldiers. They should be perfect soldiers, prepared to fight and to die for their city-state. So they actually had this kind of social revolution, but 200 years ahead of Athens, and it definitely was not a democracy. Sparta was only run by a group of a kind of band of the almost like a higher caste of Spartans, and beneath them were the helots, the slaves, and also a group of kind of middlemen. So it was a very, very rigidly hierarchical place, Sparta. So in a way, these places had such different cultures and such different ideologies. They were almost bound to clash. And I think they were jealous of one another, to be honest, as well. You know, it takes about 2 days to walk from Athens to Sparta. They're separated by mountain ranges. And I think they were always wondering, the Athenians and the Spartans, you know, what are those other guys doing? Are they doing better than us? You know, have they sorted out how to live in this world in a better way? So they were rivals with one another. And Socrates lived through the most horrific and debilitating war, one of the most awful wars that mankind has known, the Peloponnesian War, which was basically an ongoing fight of decades between Sparta and Athens. And Socrates obviously fought on the Athenian side during that war.
Was it a territorial conflict or one of ideology?
I think it was actually principally one of ideology, to be honest. But then, of course, as ever with these things, grubby land grabbing gets caught up in the higher politics. And clearly, both Athens and Sparta wanted the various city-states of Greece to be loyal to them and to them alone. And so the kind of flashpoint really is actually up in the north of Greece. If you look at a map of Greece, it's where there are three peninsulas now that kind of stick down like three fingers into the sea. And it was up here. And Socrates was sent up to fight in one of the very first battles at Potidaea, where he had to besiege a whole town. And really, again, what the Athenians were saying is, look, you ought to be allied with us. You ought to agree that you're Democrats, and then we will give you our protection. And the Spartan troops and their allies were coming in and saying, you can't throw your weight around like this, Athens. You know, these people can make up their own minds. And that's why they clashed. And interestingly, during the Peloponnesian War, Athens continued to expand its empire, because it had started an empire about 30 years before. So you get the sense that although we're told that it was an ideological conflict, actually there was something more to do with real estate at the bottom of it, and actually both the Athenians and the Spartans were very keen to expand their territories.
What do we know about the relationship between Socrates and Alcibiades during the Peloponnesian War?
So Alcibiades was Socrates' lover, his companion, his sparring partner, and the most extraordinary extraordinary person for Socrates to be paired up with, really. I mean, we don't know whether they actually had a physical relationship. There's a great the Symposium of Plato, where Alcibiades comes in and he's moaning about the fact that he remembers that even though he wanted to have a physical relationship with Socrates, Socrates was having none of it, and Alcibiades says, "Oh, it was like sleeping with my father." You know, very disappointing. But I think that almost these two were like a kind of counterpoint to one another. Socrates, of course, was famously ugly. We're told he had hairy hands. He was very thick-set. He had a strange wobbling gait. He used to kind of rock from side to side as he walked. He had these swiveling eyes kind of placed quite far on the sides of his head. So not a pretty boy by any means. Whereas Alcibiades was your kind of ideal slightly louche Greek hero. So he had long flowing blonde hair. He had a beautiful body. He had this lisp. He used to wear these very extravagant clothes and purple cloaks. He said that he would never play the flute because it made his mouth pucker up in an unattractive way. So he was kind of incredibly vain and conceited, whereas Socrates didn't care at all how he looked. People used to complain that Socrates never even took a bath. You know, he really didn't mind about his physical appearance. So they are a very, very unlikely pairing as friends. But we're told that they were messmates together, that they shared a tent on campaign. And at one point, somebody says, there's nothing Socrates loves more than philosophy. It's only Alcibiades. So clearly there was a kind of, almost like a kind of perverse attraction between the two, but not sexually perverse at all, just the fact that, as I said, in a way, Alcibiades was everything that Socrates wasn't. And you almost wonder whether Socrates was looking at Alcibiades thinking, gosh, if I can get this vain, hard-drinking, bloodthirsty, clothes-loving, materialistic man to think better, to think about what matters in this world, about what the good life is, then I've really cracked something. So I wonder if one of the reasons that Socrates was so enamoured of Alcibiades was actually he presented the most amazing challenge. Hmm.
We should say Socrates had a wife and three kids, but it wouldn't have been so shocking to friends and neighbours had he also had an affair with a man, a sexual affair.
Well, no, that's right. I mean, all Athenian men had wives. They were very loyal to their wives. They had children. But there was also definitely a culture of love between men as well. You know, it wasn't homosexuality as we think of it today, but these were very, very intense, close relationships. These were men who fought together, who lived together, who had to stand side by side together on the battlefield. And it was thought that the older men could kind of teach younger men about the world in a quite, as part of an erotic relationship, even if it wasn't sexual, but it was definitely very close. So yes, I mean, we really do have to mind shift when we think of the ancient world, and we have to think that this was something that wasn't remotely shocking. It was just accepted that in a way your strongest and your closest relationships were with men. Again, not necessarily that meant a physical relationship, but a strong emotional relationship. And basically the women were the people who stayed at home and produced your children, produced the next generation for you.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones to Lee in Richardson. Hi, Lee.
Hi. Good afternoon. I enjoy your show, and it's wonderful to hear today's program. I was curious about how did he get his wealth? Where did it come from?
Thanks for your call.
So this is the question of how Socrates got his wealth, mm-hmm. how he managed to live.
Yeah.
And a very astute question, because we're told that Socrates wouldn't ever accept even an obol, was the kind of Greek money then, that he wouldn't even accept an obol for philosophizing. He never wanted to be paid for speaking. And so you're right. In a way, it is a bit of a mystery of how did he manage to live? How did he manage to survive? And I think the answer is threefold. Socrates said, "Don't pay me for being a philosopher. However, you can give me a really good dinner." And actually, dinner in Athens really meant something. I mean, dinners could go on for 3 days. So in some ways, if you were being given the food that you needed, that's one big expense that's cut out. He possibly had an aristocratic patron who helped him to buy the armor that he needed to go to war, because as an Athenian soldier, as a hoplite, you had to provide your own shield, your own hoplon, your own sword, your own helmet, your own greaves for your legs. So somebody must have helped him out with that. But I think from very young, from the age of about 19, Athenians recognized he was something special. You know, they recognized that this was a man who really was a genius. I mean, genius, I think, is a word that's overused now, but I think we can apply that to Socrates. So I think he probably had some friends in high places. But also, thirdly, he was genuinely very, very non-materialistic. I mean, he famously never wore shoes. He always walked barefoot. He just had one rather threadbare cloak. You know, he didn't bother about how he looked, and basically he just kind of wore his clothes until they dropped off him. You know, he had no interest in being the dandy and looking like the man about town. So I think he probably led a very, very, very frugal existence. So he didn't need that much money, and the money that he did need was given to him by friends and supporters and those who were very impressed by his work.
He was very unlike other men of his day in that respect, that he wasn't materialistic. Is that right? I mean, Athens was a pretty glitzy place.
Very glitzy. I mean, you know, Athens suddenly becomes super rich for two reasons. It becomes a democracy, and then it discovers silver in the silver mines in Larion, which just to the south of Athens. So suddenly you have a huge amount of raw material wealth coming pouring into the city, and of course Athens minted its famous silver owls, these lovely little coins which have got the symbol of Athena's owl on them, which are still turning up in their hundreds and thousands in digs in Athens today. So it had a lot of wealth for that reason, and because it had become such a successful empire. And those who fell under the auspices of the Athenian Empire had to pay tribute to the mother city. And there's an incredible, if any of you listeners out there ever managed to get to Athens, go to have a look at the National Epigraphic Museum, because there's this incredible, huge stone. I mean, it must be about 30, 40 feet high. And on it is carved in minute, beautiful, perfect Greek lettering the names of all the cities that owe tribute to Athens. And you just have a look at that, and then you really realize the amount of wealth that must have come pouring into the city in Socrates' day.
You say that he wouldn't accept money to lecture. How did he decide who he would sort of take on as a pupil?
Well, this is a thing that really sets Socrates apart from the other philosophers of his day, is that lots of those philosophers who are called sophists, they would be more like formal teachers. You know, they would charge for their lessons. They might do big outdoor lecture programs where thousands of people would come, or they'd have these kind of smaller seminar rooms. But what's different about Socrates is that he walks through the streets of Athens. He walks through the Agora, the marketplace in the center of Athens, and he will talk to anyone who will listen to him. And this is the thing that I said really marks him out, that he's democratic in the true sense of the word, that he thinks if he's got something worthwhile saying, anybody, however poor, however uneducated, however rough, they have a right to be able to hear him. So really, his lecture hall were the back streets of Athens.
Would that have included slaves?
Slaves would have been able to hear what he was saying, but I don't think he'd have gone and sought them out, because slaves, you know, they were working 14, 15-hour days. So they would have caught what Socrates was saying, and he was very compassionate in the way that he dealt with other people. He talked very kindly about women, which most men of the day, didn't do. He talked very kindly about slaves as well, but I think he wouldn't have sought slaves out just because, to be honest, they wouldn't have been allowed to listen to him. They would have been, you know, out in the fields working, running errands for their masters, cleaning the homes. I think, sadly, as a slave, you had no leisure time. And interestingly, the Greek word for leisure time in ancient Greece was skole, which gives us our word scholar. So as a leisurable person, at the time, a person who had time on your hands, what you were able to be was a scholar, somebody who could listen to great ideas.
So you write that he spoke kindly of women and respectfully. He also, on the other hand, enjoyed his time with prostitutes.
Yes, he did. But, I mean, you know, any Athenian worth his salt has spent time with prostitutes in 5th century Athens. Again, this wasn't considered a kind of morally bad thing to do. There was a whole area down just outside the gates of Athens. So the kind of red light district was just kind of just beyond the limits of the city. It's an area called the Keramikos, where all the potters of the city worked. And we know that there are numbers of prostitutes lined up there. The Athenians have a wonderful phrase for it. They used to say that people would go down to the Keramikos for middle-of-the-day marriages, which is the most brilliant euphemism, I think. Yeah, and Socrates, would have spent a bit of time there too.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Ed in Arlington. Hi, Ed.
Hi. When I was studying classics a little over 20 years ago, and specifically Plato's Dialogues, we were taught that we didn't really know that if Socrates was a real person or not, because all that we heard about him was from Plato's Dialogues and Plato's writings. And so I'm wondering if that has changed since. Have we uncovered any evidence to substantiate that Socrates was really living, walking, breathing person, or was really a fictional character?
Thanks for your call. What do you know about that, Bethany?
Well, I think we know that he was a real person because he crops up not just in Plato's Dialogues, but also in the plays of Aristophanes and in the works of the military historian Xenophon. And as I said, it would be very, very odd if these three different men, who weren't great pals, you know, they weren't conspirators, it'd be very peculiar if they'd all invented this character called Socrates. So that would just be weird, really. But also there's more archaeological evidence that tells us that he definitely did live and breathe and work in Athens. For instance, a later writer, Diogenes Laertius, talks about the house of Simon the cobbler, where Socrates spoke and where he delivered a lot of his greatest ideas. And this was, again, just at the corner of the Agora. And the young men of the city would come to listen to him in this cobbler's workshop. And one of the artifacts that's been dug up from the Agora is a potsherd from a cobbler's shop. And we know it's a cobbler's shop because it's full of tacks, little metal nails. And also little ivory eyelets that have been stitched into shoes for where the laces went. And on this pot, it says Simones. So we know that Simon was there. You know, there was a cobbler called Simon. He did make pots. So again, that kind of evidence tells us that actually it would be impossible for all these disparate people to kind of make up these details of Socrates' lives that appear in these different sources. So yes, I think he was real. And I think probably...
Bethany, let me have you pause for a minute. We're going to take a quick break. My guest is Bethany Hughes. Her new book is The Hemlock Cup, Socrates, Athens, and the Search for the Good Life. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is broadcaster, historian, and author Bethany Hughes. Her new book is The Hemlock Cup, Socrates, Athens, and the Search for the Good Life. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Before the break, Bethany, you were responding to Ed's question as to whether or not it was possible Socrates was some kind of fictional character or a figment of people's collective imagination. You were mentioning this amazing find of the cobbler shop where Socrates liked to hang out and talk.
Absolutely right. So this is this cobbler shop that belonged to a man called Simon. And it's one of those things that we're told in the historical sources. And for centuries, people said, oh, you know, we're sure that's not real. We're sure this is just made up. But actually then archaeologists have dug just on the outside of the Agora, the marketplace, and have indeed found this cobbler's shop, as I was saying, full of nails and little eyelets for laces and a shard of a pot. And on the pot it says Simones. So we know that this belonged to a man called Simon. So I think there's no doubt that Socrates was real. Although teachers, you know, were right a few years ago to kind of say, how kind of raise a finger of caution in a way and say, how do we know this? Because we don't have a single word that he wrote down. But I think almost people point out that difficulty more to make us very rigorous in the way that we look at history rather than suggesting there's actually a possibility that Socrates didn't exist. As I said, if he didn't exist, a lot of people got together and wrote about him in the most convincing way. So it's the most extraordinary conspiracy theory plot hatched in antiquity, and I don't think that was actually the case. I think he was definitely a real man.
So he was quite well known in his own day, which must also have meant that he had enemies.
He absolutely had enemies. You know, he was one of those popular people that nobody could quite understand why he was so charismatic. As I said earlier, he was very unattractive to look at. He wasn't conventionally beautiful. He was eccentric. In a way, he was the opposite of what Athens wanted men to be at the time. Athens wanted men to be these rather beautiful, clean-shaven, you know, handsome, strapping lads who loved enjoying the fruits of empire. And Socrates always says, no, you know, I'm not saying these things are bad. He has this wonderful quote when he says, I'm not saying that we don't need city walls and warships and glittering statues. We do need all of these things. But what's the point of any of them if those people within those city walls aren't happy? You know, again, I think it's an incredible comment, really, because I think in this day and age, it's something that we're all asking ourselves as well. What's the point of all this if we're not happy? You know, happiness surely has to be the kind of basic currency for life. And I think that Socrates, he started to rattle people. He was immensely popular. He was slightly eccentric. He was clearly had the most brilliantly perceptive and radical mind. And as the years go on, I mean, he is allowed to philosophize freely in the city for close on 50 years. But as the years go on, as Athens itself starts to be a city which has terrible troubles, which is beginning to lose the Peloponnesian War, when its arch enemies, the Spartans, are beginning to get the upper hand, when Athenians are really beginning, I think for the first time, to kind of doubt that they are invincible in the 5th century, then I think this is a moment when public opinion starts to turn against Socrates.
So he's 70 years old, and he's put on trial for, paraphrasing the exact charges here, for corrupting young minds and for disrespecting the gods.
Absolutely right. So the religious charge is key. The fact that he's said to disregard the city's traditional gods and to introduce new gods, that would mean something now. It meant something extraordinary then in ancient Athens, because ancient Athens was a place that had no separate word for religion. Hmm. Religion was everywhere and in everything. It was stitched through every aspect of political and social and cultural life. And ancient Athenians would really have thought that just around the corner they'd have met Zeus in disguise, or some kind of spirit of the springs, or a kind of spirit in an apple on a tree. They really believed that gods and goddesses were all around them the whole time. And also they thought that their security and their strength lay entirely in the lap of the gods. So this notion that Socrates is somehow questioning that, or is somehow treating it in a slightly unorthodox way, was very, very, very troubling to the ancient Athenians. I mean, it's a very interesting question, this, because actually, if you look at Socrates, he's in fact a very pious man. He goes to religious festivals. He's very interested in the gods. He goes and makes sacrifices himself. He believes in the Delphi Oracle, for instance, all these kind of big religious institutions. But he has what he called his inner daimonion, his inner spirit. He used to go off into these kind of trances where he'd just think deep thoughts for hours and hours and hours. He used to say that his daimonion, his spirit, spoke to him. And I think for the Athenians, this was very troubling, because this was almost as if he was introducing some strange, new, private kind of god to the city. Because we're all used in the 21st century to imagining that we can have a personal, private relationship with our god. That wasn't the case in Athens. Relationships with the gods was very public. It was something you did together as a community. You did it together physically by going and making sacrifices, by conducting rituals, by meeting in public. It wasn't a personal, individual relationship. And I think that was actually one of the things that the Athenians found most difficult to handle with Socrates.
Was the concern that this sort of heretical behavior could bring the wrath of Mount Olympus down on the rest of the city?
Oh, no doubt. You know, the Athenians and anybody in the ancient world would just presume that if there was a natural disaster, if there was a terrible failure in a war, if somebody's career has crumbled suddenly, that this was all being decided upon by the gods as they sat around on Mount Olympus, kind of playing with mankind as if they were a series of toy soldiers or puppets. And so absolutely, they would have been very, very concerned that by what they saw of it as questioning the gods, Socrates might cause trouble for each and every individual Athenian.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Mark in Dallas. Hey, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
Good. Hey, I've just tuned into the show. I just had a quick question. The actual issue between Socrates and his accusers, I know they accused him of corrupting the young minds, but what does the author think that the actual issue was? Was it superstition versus reality, or and what was the date of his death? I mean, do you have an idea?
Yes. So we know very specifically the date of his death was 399 BC. So it was just into the new century, as we date it. He was 70 years old. And it's fascinating, isn't it? Because it is the million-dollar question. You know, why was Socrates charged with the crimes? Why was he then condemned to death and forced to drink hemlock poison in his cell? So he was forced to commit kind of state-sponsored suicide. And I think really that the answer is that he was just, he'd got to the point in his life where when the city was feeling robust and strong, when everything was going very well for Athens, they could tolerate his eccentricities. They could tolerate the fact that he seemed to be questioning the orthodoxy of the world around them. But as Athenian life started to crumble, as Athenians lost in battles, they'd suffered a terrible plague, they'd seen their sons, brothers, husbands come home in the equivalent of body bags, and they suddenly didn't want somebody in their city center asking questions the whole time, which is what Socrates did. He always asked questions. In those times of crisis, actually, you want answers. You don't want questions. So I think the unfortunate truth is that Socrates was actually just caught up in the brutal context of the day, and suddenly Athens, rather than tolerating him, needed somebody to blame for the misfortune that they were suffering. And I think, actually, as Socrates himself said, amazingly, in his trial, he has this incredible speech where he says, "The thing is, Athenians, it's not my crimes that are going to convict me. It's rumor, slander, gossip, public opinion. It's this notion that people are saying things about me behind my back that I can't deal with." He says, "It's as if I was boxing with shadows. How can I defend myself?" So in a way, I think it's that awful moment that we've probably all experienced at some point in our lives where you suddenly just see public opinion turning against you or turning against somebody that you know. And I think that's what happened to Socrates in his courtroom.
One would think that with one of the most brilliant minds in human history, he could have mounted for himself an effective defense. Why didn't he do so?
It's so fascinating, this. So absolutely, as you say, Socrates, you know, the master of wordplay, who could argue anybody under the table, you know, a man who could kind of argue himself out of the most extraordinary situation, doesn't do this. He doesn't mount a sufficient defense. And I think, again, though, this is why I have such huge respect for the man, because in a way, what he refuses to do in his courtroom is he refuses to play the game. What he could have done is he could have come up with an incredibly moving, heart-rending speech that talked about the wife and small children that he was going to leave behind, that talked about the glory that Athens once was and could be again and how he could be a part of that. I'm sure he had the intellectual capacity to do that, but he refuses to do that because he says, actually, I am speaking the truth. I am innocent. And I shouldn't need to defend myself against you. And then he really annoys the crowd in the courtroom because there are two votes, and they vote to condemn him. And they ask him to propose an alternative to death. And you'll think that he's going to come up with a sensible alternative, like a fine or some kind of punishment. But actually what he says is, I tell you what, I think how you should punish me is that because all I've done in my life is do good for the city, why don't you give me free dinners for the rest of my life? And I think that is the real watershed moment in the trial, where he's obviously furious that he's being condemned of crimes which he is certain he didn't convict. And so he says, don't punish me, just give me free dinners, because all I've done is look for the good. And at that point, the judge and the jury, 500 good men of Athens, I think that's when they think, this man is just playing with us. He has no respect for the court. And it's at that moment that the majority overwhelmingly vote for his death.
Is a chalice of hemlock a particularly painful way to die?
Yes, it's a horrible way to die, because it attacks your nervous system. So your mind is completely alert, but you feel slowly all your body packing, your body functions and your organs packing up one by one. Your muscles are trying to spasm, but because your body is becoming paralyzed, they can't do that. And your mind stays absolutely active even as you realize that your lungs are no longer able to function and you can't breathe. So although you don't actually writhe around in agony and vomit and have diarrhea and spit as we once thought you did with hemlock, so in a strange way, it's quite a dignified death. But for somebody who had such a brilliant and active mind, what a terrible way to go, to have your mind absolutely sharp and to realize that your beloved city-state, because Socrates loved Athens, your beloved city-state has asked for your death.
Did he leave any last words?
Interestingly, his actual last words were very bizarre, and he says to his friends, can you go and sacrifice a cock, a bird, to Asclepius, who was the god of healing, a kind of new god in the city. And people have analyzed these words endlessly. You know, what did it mean? Was he in a way proving that he was pious, that his Athenian citizens had said that he was irreligious, but he's kind of saying, look, even with my dying breath, I'm asking for a sacrifice to be made to the gods. Or I wonder, was it something actually much more personal and rather poignant, that this man is slowly dying an agonizing death? And in a way, what would you do other than perhaps cry out to your mother or to your beloved or to the god of healing? And I think that's actually what Socrates is doing right at the end of his life. He's crying out in agony to the god of healing.
I know that you traveled a lot in the places where Socrates would have been. Can you talk about your favorite physical spot where you really felt like you could understand who this man was?
I think it has to be walking through the streets of the Agora, of the marketplace of Athens, because this was Socrates' favorite place. He loved the marketplace. He loved wandering through, sniffing those scents that we were talking about right at the beginning of the program, the smell of frying fish, watching the world go by, trying to understand people as they try to understand their place in the world, and then talking, as Socrates said, talking to anybody who would listen to him, anybody who would listen to his philosophizing. And if you walk through those streets today, you can see the kind of ruins of the buildings around you. You can feel the warm Mediterranean sun on your face. You can see the Acropolis rock with the amazing Parthenon temple above you. And at that moment, really, you can be in two times at once. You can be both in the 21st century and you can be back in Socrates' 5th century Athens.
The new book by historian, author, and broadcaster Bettany Hughes is called The Hemlock Cup, Socrates, Athens, and the Search for the Good Life. Bettany, it's been a fascinating hour. I really appreciate you being with us.
It's been a delight. Thanks so much for letting me on.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.